Today's Tay Show will be on case 25 in the Pi Yan Lu, the Heikigan Roku. Case 25 is entitled The Master of Rengeho's Staff. Engo's introduction. If the action of one's ki is not independent of one's enlightenment, one slips into a sea of poison. If one's words do not astonish the crowd, one slips into the conventional. If you can distinguish black from white in the moment of a spark's being struck, and can tell life from death in the instant of a flash of lightning, then you will be able to command all quarters and stand firm like a 1,000-foot cliff. Who could ever be so? See the following. Main subject. The master of Rengeho Cottage held out his staff and said to his disciples, when in olden times a man reached the state of enlightenment, why did he not remain there? No one could answer, and he replied for them, because it is of no use in the course of life. And he asked them again, after all, what will you do with it? And once again he said in their stead, taking no notice of others, throwing his staff over his shoulder, he goes straight ahead and journeys deep into the recesses of the 100,000 mountains. Secho's verse, his eyes filled with sand, his ears filled with clay. Even among the 1,000 mountains, he does not remain. Falling blossoms, flowing streams, he leaves no trace. Open your eyes wide, and you'll wonder where he's gone. So I want to thank everybody for coming to practice Zen this morning. Many people arrived here at 7 and some at 8, some at 9:30, and some are here now. Or earlier this morning, we were all sitting deeply. I could look at the screen and I could see everybody sitting in deep samadhi. It was really wonderful. And I'm very glad everybody can be here. Thank you so much for coming this morning. Our lives have been turned upside down. I think that's fair to say. You know, I was just reading some instructions for getting ready for the semester at Rutgers, because we are going to do most of our instruction online. And I was reading some memos about how to conduct class, and I'm going to look at some videos this weekend on that. And I must say, I really miss not going, and I miss the rituals of going into class. You know, I've been teaching at Rutgers for a long time, something like 36 years, and you know, I love fall. I love to get ready for class. And have you know, all my reading list ready and all my assignments written up, and going into the classroom and seeing the students face to face. That's a wonderful ritual. I really love that. And you know, I work really hard to know everybody's name by week two. We have a roster that has it's a photo roster, so we can see everybody's faces on the roster under their name. And you know, I worked very hard to be able to do that. And now I'll be able to do it much more easily because I'll see everybody's head is a little square in Zoom and I can read their name. So a little easier in some ways, but I'm going to really miss that human contact. You know, our lives have been turned upside down in so many ways. We can't go overseas for vacation. You can't go to Mexico. You can't go to Canada right now. You can't go to England or France, any place like that. And it's probably the case that we're looking at another, you know, 4 or 5 months, possibly another shutdown. So all of that's you know, troubling, right? I mean, I think we're all feeling that our lives have been turned upside down. You know, you might feel like, you know, there's a wonderful saying in English, all dressed up with nowhere to go, right? I mean, I know many people who are all dressed up. I have a friend of mine, he's an attorney in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And on his Facebook page, he said, well, I'm getting ready to go to work. And he had on a Oxford cloth shirt and a tie. And under the shirt, you know, the shirt, it looks like he was going to work from the head down to his waist. And then he was wearing his bicycle pants, you know, his cycling pants under that, you know, and he had on socks. So he's on the computer all day looking like he's in his office. But I think a lot of us are like that. We're all dressed up with nowhere to go. And that's frustrating, right? It's frustrating. I'm a big fan of Rolling Stone magazine. I don't know if you subscribe to Rolling Stone magazine, but I love the music journalism. But I also think Rolling Stone has some of the best long-form political journalism in the United States. It's really superb, and so I've been a subscriber for like 40 years or something. But I was also reading an interview with an actor and also some musicians. And they were talking about how the musicians were saying how frustrating it is not to be able to go on the road, right? I mean, they live to perform and they can't do that. And I was reading this interview with this actor, Billy Crudup. I don't know if you know who Billy Crudup is, but he's a pretty good actor. He was in a wonderful movie called Almost Famous. If you haven't seen Almost Famous, I highly recommend that you see it. It's a wonderful movie. And he played a rock star in there, and he was very charismatic. And in the interview, he said, you know, I've been in these roles that everybody defines as breakout roles. Every time I've been in one of these movies, critics have said, and a fantastic performance and a breakout performance by Billy Crudup, and that means his next movie is going to be a big star. And he says that has never happened. It's like they'll do a hell of a breakout role and then nothing, a breakout role and then nothing. And he said, finally, I'm in this show. He's in a show that I myself have never seen because I don't watch that much TV, but it's called The Morning Show. Anyway, it's a big hit show, and he said, finally, I'm in this, you know, a monster hit, and the first season we won all these Emmy Awards, and he said, now, nothing, you know, we're not filming, we're not producing, I'm reading some scripts, and he said, mostly I'm learning how to make pancakes in the morning. So that's frustrating, right? And our lives have been turned upside down, and we have our suit hanging in the closet, or our clothes for work hanging in the closet, and you know, we put on our shirts and we sit down in front of our computer, maybe. So, but you know, those kind of things, that kind of thing is actually, nobody wants it. I'm frustrated too, but in a certain way, it's potentially quite liberating. It's quite wonderful, really. Because we realize, in a certain sense, how artificial so many things in our life really are. Things that seemed natural and absolutely obvious suddenly seem unnatural and artificial and maybe even unnecessary. You know, I was reading about a number of, you probably have been following if you read the newspapers, that a number of big clothing stores have closed. So, you know, Men's Warehouse is a bankrupt. There's a very famous store in New York, men's clothing store. Actually, it's a clothing store in general, both men and women, called Barney's, and that's closed. And it's like one clothing store after another, because, you know, basically people are living in their sweatpants and their t-shirts. And these stores have tended to run on very thin margins. So now they're, and, you know, it's a terrible thing. If you're in the clothing business, I don't know if anybody here is in the clothing business. Actually, I think clothing is, I think clothing is very interesting, right? I think something like a kimono is beautiful, right? Beautiful. And I think it's a real achievement to have created such a magical piece of clothing. And so clothing is really magical and important. And it allows us to communicate in all these wonderful ways. T-shirts are not very communicative, you know, they're not very eloquent. And so clothing is wonderful, but, you know, we can also be prisoners of clothing, right? I mean, when I got out of college, you know, if you wanted to go to a job interview in English, you had to wear a suit, and you had to have a decent suit. And at that time, I think it was 1985, I think I was making something like $7,000 a year. And, you know, that was before taxes. And I had to get a suit for an interview, and it was like a serious outlay. To me, it felt like a real arm and a leg. And I had this suit, and I wore it to the interview, and I don't think I wore it again until I got a job. And then when I got a job, I started wearing my suit again. You know, as soon as I didn't have to wear a tie and a suit, I stopped wearing them. And I'm glad to see them gone, right? It was liberating for me to get rid of a suit. So, clothes can be imprisoning. They can be wonderful if we treat them playfully. But, you know, clothes can become imprisoning. You know, people judge you by your clothes, you know. So if you didn't have a suit that was, you know, you'd spend a couple $100 on your suit. If you didn't have a suit that said, this suit is worth several $100, people might mark you down in certain contexts, you know. Or there are other signifiers of successfulness, you know, in women's clothes too. You know, there are certain outfits that say, I want to be taken seriously, I'm a player. And now, you know, some of that's going away, and maybe that's good. Maybe that's a good thing in certain ways. I love the artfulness of clothes, but, you know, when we take clothes too seriously, they become oppressive, right? They become oppressive. It's kind of refreshing to see people, you know, it's kind of refreshing to see people without a suit coat. They just have a decent shirt on, and there's something liberating about it. So, you know, we live in this world where all these things that were super important suddenly aren't as important. Another example of this is cars, right? For so many people, a car is a major statement of their identity, right? So you'll see people driving down the street with, I was going for my walk yesterday morning, and somebody drove by in a BMW coupe, and it's this sporty little thing, and basically it's probably $100,000 just drove by. In fact, I'm probably naive, it's probably worth more than $100,000. I wouldn't know, you know. Earlier I was driving to the grocery store, and somebody drove by in a Tesla, and it was one of the sort of upper range Teslas. So you're looking at like $80,000 to $100,000 machine. And it occurred to me, who are they impressing with these cars anymore, right? I mean, many people don't leave the house for a week. So, you know, the suits maybe are not as important as they were. You know, my friend, the lawyer, is a pretty successful attorney. And he spends most of the day in his bicycle pants with a you know, a $35 Lands' End Oxford cloth shirt, you know, and that's his attire these days. And, you know, you might have a Tesla that's worth $100,000, but it mostly sits in your driveway, and it's not impressing anybody these days, right? It's not like you drive to work and everybody sees your Tesla and says, oh my gosh, you know, such a successful person. And you know, I realized that sometimes you have to do that. My brother was in business, and he had a pretty expensive car. And I asked my brother, I said, why do you have that car? And he said, oh, I have to have that car. When I go to see clients, they want to see that I drive a very expensive car that says I'm on the ball, I know what I'm doing. He basically said, if I drove your car, I wouldn't get any work, you know. So I understand, you know, there's a kind of semiotics, there's a kind of signal you send with your possessions, right? But it's kind of wonderful to see some of that slip away, because we suddenly realize that a lot of what we valued obsessively and made ourselves unhappy about, right, is really not that important. You know, when I was growing up in the, grew up in the 60s and early 70s, when cars were really important status symbols. And I remember my parents, my father in particular, would trade in his car every like couple of years, and it was a terrible business decision, right? You know, he'd have a car, he'd get close to paying it off, and then he'd trade it in and start paying on a new car. And it was all about appearing successful, right? He couldn't drive what's called a late model car. He had to have a current car like my brother. It had to say, I'm a person of importance, right? And I remember my mother used to pay the bills, and she would, you know, my parents would argue about money because they didn't have enough, right? And you know, I can remember the car being an issue. Like, you know, why do we have to get a new car? And I have to have a new car, but we can't pay for the old car, you know? So a lot of unhappiness can be occasioned by things that that could seem trivial under other circumstances. So in a way, right now, everything that's happening has this kind of sickening quality in a way, because things that seem so important and things that seem so real are starting to seem unimportant and unreal. Now many people don't drive to work. You know, so, you know, if you, in the old days, before COVID, BC, before COVID, you know, people used to have to get to work by like 8:30, right? You actually sometimes see people even had to punch in, but you generally had to get to work by a certain time. So that meant getting on the Garden State, getting on the Turnpike, fighting your way into Manhattan, or fighting your way into, worse yet, you know, into someplace like Queens, or taking the train into Manhattan and then having to catch a train uptown or something, a bus or something uptown. It was this horrible beating that everybody took, you know, and now suddenly, you know, you can sort of get to your computer by a certain time or get your work done. A lot of people are enjoying sort of flex time. And actually it's a really liberating. So this thing that seems so real, like getting to work on time is like a fundamental lesson of the work world. Now it's not really, it's falling apart, it's disappearing. And that can seem frightening. You know, I imagine that people who grew up in the age of suits and who grew up and people who have invested in big cars, you know, like in $100,000 Teslas and so on, you know, they might lie awake at night and feel like their world is falling apart, because all the things that they decided defined them, you know, their car, their clothing, and so on, those things are all sort of like eroding around them or going up in smoke, right? And now suddenly it's like, what is worth what? You know, what is important? You know, How am I going to signal who I am if I'm only just have access to Zoom, right? So anyway, this is actually, from a Zen standpoint, a very, very good experience, even though nobody likes it. The master of Rengeho Cottage held out his staff and said to his disciples, when in olden times a person reached the state of enlightenment, why did he not remain there? So you know, what he's saying is kind of surprising, right? Because if you think about Buddhism, you know, Buddhism's core value or its most important thing is the enlightenment experience. You know, we're told in the early sutras that the Buddha studied with some of the most important meditation teachers of his time. The sutras even give us the names. There was a guy named Udraka Ramaputra and Alara Kalama. So these people were historical figures, and they were, there's some supporting evidence that they really existed, and they were great meditation teachers. And one of them, Alara Kalama, taught Mushin meditation, actually something like emptiness meditation. And the other, Udraka Ramaputra, taught something like samadhi meditation, stabilizing the mind. And the Buddha, the sutras say, studied with both of them and was not happy. He studied with Udraka Ramaputra and learned how to enter deep samadhi. And Udraka said, okay, you've done it. You enter the deepest samadhi of anybody in our community. I will make you my heir. You'll take over the community and you'll teach the world how to enter samadhi. And the Buddha said, you know, I don't think that's enlightenment. You know, it's a nice state. You know, it's nice to be in samadhi. It's peaceful. It's still. I feel better when I'm in samadhi, but I don't think it's enlightenment. So then he left Udraka, and then he went to work with the other teacher. And the other teacher taught him how to enter emptiness, so a little bit beyond samadhi. And the Buddha and Alara Kalama, the other teacher, went to the Buddha and said, look, you know, you can enter the deepest emptiness of anybody I know. I've never seen anybody like that, do it like that, you know, and I'd like you to take over our community. And the Buddha said, no, I don't think that's enlightenment. You know, I can enter deep samadhi and I can enter emptiness, but I don't think that's enlightenment. So the Buddha left his second teacher and his first teacher, and he went off and he practiced on his own. The sutras say that he was dissatisfied with the most advanced teachers of his time and was practicing on his own, and he belonged to a little circle of five other people who were sitting with him. And the sutras say he tried different meditation tactics. He tried fasting almost to the point of death. Many different things, and we're told that he eventually, after fasting didn't work, he almost starved to death. He left his five companions, and he went to a little village, and a woman in the village, a little girl in the village, saw him and was so alarmed by his emaciated state that she brought him some milk with rice in it. You know, it's very simple, easy to digest, and nourishing. And he ate it, and his strength returned, and he decided, I think I can do this, you know. So he thanked her, and he went off by himself. And we're told that, you know, he sat all through, with the new energy provided to him by the rice, he sat all night. And in the morning, he had his Daikensho experience, his Great Awakening experience. In the Mahayana, we believe that he had his Daikensho when he saw the morning star. And so enlightenment is what made the Buddha the Buddha. And after his enlightenment, the sutras say that he was so blown away by the experience that he didn't think that it could be communicated to anybody. And he also didn't think it was teachable, because he didn't think anybody would understand when he tried to teach them. So he practiced really with the most advanced meditation teachers of his time. He went off and sat by himself, and he discovered this condition we call enlightenment, right? And then after he had his enlightenment experience, he decided nobody will get this. This is completely beyond any categories of thinking. And then the sutra says that like a little god popped up. There was one of the gods popped up. And he says to the Buddha, world honored one, you're mistaken. You know, look at the world. There's so much suffering in the world, and there's so much unhappiness. If you don't help people, who will help them? And the Buddha says, well, yeah, but I don't think anybody will understand it, me. And the little god says, actually, there are people will understand you. There are people of noble intention who will understand what you're trying to teach and who will follow your path and will also wake up. So the Buddha resolved to teach. And for the next 45 years of his life, he taught meditation practice and the precepts, the ethical life, and so on. And the sutras, the early sutras, record that many people had daikensho. Many people woke up. And not only monks and nuns, but also lay people. By my count, something like 26 lay people in the Pali Sutras have daikensho, have a great awakening experience. So enlightenment is the core of everything Buddhism is about. It's what we're about, right? So it's a little bit shocking when the master of Rengeho Cottage, right, held out his staff and he said to his disciples, in olden times, when a man reached the state of enlightenment, why did he not remain there? See? So this is a bit of a shock because, you know, when we think about enlightenment, we think of it as the be-all and the end-all. Right, it's what we're all striving to achieve. Right? What we're striving to achieve, and the sutras, koans are full of stories about people who've been practicing for 20 or 30 years and haven't been able to have that experience. So there's a very famous koan about a very senior person in the monastery named Jojoza. And he's been practicing for 25 or 30 years and he hasn't had daikensho. And he finally has daikensho when Lin Ji slaps his face, actually. And he has this daikensho experience. There's other stories like this. There was a monk who had been practicing for about 25 or 30 years who hadn't had daikensho, and he got so discouraged, he left the monastery, and he went and lived in a little hut and continued to practice Zen, but he had given up any thought of having daikensho. He thought, oh, this will never happen. And the sutra says that one day when he was out raking the yard, he found a broken piece of roof tile. And he picked it up and he threw it across the yard and it hit a piece of bamboo, and when it went ping, he had his daikensho. So you know, daikensho is something that we Zen people really believe in and we strive to achieve, right? We strive to achieve. And now the master of Rengeho Cottage is saying, once you reach it, you're not going to, why, when people reach it, do they not remain there? And so we thought it was like the solution, or we thought it was like the final state, and yet somehow you don't remain there. And he asked that to his students. You know, you can imagine they're all doing zazen. He comes in and says it's like koan practice in the old days was just the teacher would give you a question and you wanted to see if you could answer it. So he comes into the zendo and he says what he says, and nobody can answer. Nobody has a clue. So then he answers for them. He says, because it is of no use in the course of life. So, you know, that's even in a way more shocking than the first statement, right? That meditation is of no use to you in your life, right? It's like, well, what the hell? Why are we doing this then, right? What's this all about? You know, I sometimes in the afternoon, I'm working on my computer all day, and I'll take a break and have lunch around 2:30. And I'll go down and I'll catch WNYC and I'll listen to WNYC in the afternoon. And I can't remember her name, but she has a radio program in the afternoon and she actually has like a minute of Zen, right? It's like, she says, oh, everything is so stressful. Let's take a minute and just center ourselves, right? Like, I don't think she says a minute of Zen. I think she says a minute of centering. So, you know, she says, let's all just sit down and for a minute we'll be quiet. And it's like, well, I don't think a minute is going to do it, right? You know, I don't think, to be honest with you. But I like what she's, I'm glad she's interested, let me put it that way. And she says, now, you know, isn't that after it's over, the minute is over, it's like, now we can get back to work. And you know, Americans are pretty utilitarian people, right? We like to do things that have a cash value, that have a benefit, right? There aren't very many bookstores in the world anymore. There used to be something called bookstores where you went and you could buy books. You didn't go online, you actually walked into the store, and the books in the bookstore used to be organized by topic, right? So you would go into the bookstore, like there's still occasionally a Barnes & Noble. I think there's one on Route 22. I think it's still in business. But you go in and there's a section of the books that says a heading, there's a placard that says psychology. And then there's a placard that says history, world history, American history. There's something on cooking. There's a big section on cooking. And sometimes there's a section on that, like New Age, and then there's a section on self-help, and then there's a section on like Eastern religion, Western religion, and Eastern religion. And if you go to the Eastern religion section, there are so many books that are about how to use Zen or how to use meditation or Buddhism to be successful in your life. So it'll say, that's a book, 24/7 Zen, right? And it's like a calendar, and on every page there's like an inspirational aphorism, right, from Zen. And there are lots of books on Buddhism that are, you know, like how, you know, basically the Zen of finance, or the Zen of salesmanship, or the Zen of this, you know, or that. And I understand, you know, people want to, that they're stressed in their lives and they feel overwhelmed. And, you know, having a minute of Zen in the afternoon can sort of ground you or center you if you're feeling terribly disoriented and pressured. And, you know, you can practice Zen in order to be more successful at what you do. That's okay. That's not a crime. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. But you know, that's a very limiting way to practice Zen, to be more successful, right? To be more successful. Because you're still accepting uncritically or on faith, the concept of success. See? And if you're feeling very stressed and you're worried that you're not going to be successful, you are in what Buddhism calls samsara. You're in an unhealthy place. See? And the more, you know, the more you think or worry about success, the farther and farther away you get from the reality of what you're really doing. So for example, you know, I have to write. I write things sometimes. And if I think about, if I sit down and I have to write an article, let's say, or a piece of journalism, and I say, this has to be the best thing in the magazine. This has to be the best thing in the journal. It's got to be. You know, I will have a miserable day, right? And it'll be horrible. Because every time I write something, I say, well, that's not the best. And then I'll write, that's no good. You know, that's obvious. You know, that's, you know. So it becomes a hell, right? Because you're trying to be successful. You're trying to win at a certain game, right? You're trying to be brilliant or whatever. And this is so destructive. Right? It's so destructive. I have found it so much better if you just say to yourself, this is an interesting idea. Let's see where it goes. Right? Let's just see where it goes. And, you know, sometimes it goes nowhere. You could spend a week working on something and realize, you know, this is not panning out. And you just throw it in the trash. Now, there's a certain person who would say, oh my God, you just burned up a week. You know, that is not cost effective. That's, but I think it's a wonderful way to live, you know, to find some ideas that are interesting and just explore them and see where they go, right? See where they go. And sometimes they take you to a place that's fascinating, right? It's just like, oh my gosh, who would have thought of any of this? It's so interesting, right? For me, that's a really exciting thing. And it might or might not end up being something that I can cash in on. You know, it might not have any value in terms of some kind of a marketplace of ideas. But when I'm going through the process, I feel so alive. I feel so happy and alive. And it's the same thing, you know, poetry. Poetry is, without a doubt, the most useless thing in the world. It's totally useless, right? It's utterly, totally useless. First of all, even people like Billy Collins, you know, even poets who are really successful, they haven't made money off of their poetry. Nobody sells enough poetry to make money. You know, people like Tom Clancy put out these books and they make billions of dollars. They don't write them themselves. They actually have a studio of people who write in their voice. But, you know, writing poetry is incredibly labor intensive. You know, you might spend weeks on 20 lines, right? I was just reading a poet I love, Mark Doty is his name. He's a fan. He teaches at Rutgers. He's a fantastic poet. And I was just reading some of his poetry, just thinking, man, this must have taken so... I mean, maybe he just banged it out, but I don't think so. I think, you know, he worked on this poetry. And, you know, 20 lines could be... You could burn up a couple of weeks on 20 lines. But, you know, when I read it, you know, I might spend the whole day reading this poetry, and I feel so alive. I feel so happy. And it changes. I go outside and I think, you know, I never thought of... He wrote a poem about his dog. He has a bunch of poems about dogs, you know. And I was looking at dogs. I don't have a dog. I'm more of a cat person, right? But I was looking at this friend of mine and his dogs, and I realized they love each other. Mark Doty's poems helped me to see this relationship that I wouldn't have noticed. You know, I realized, oh my gosh, this is a deep relationship between Oscar and his dog, you know. So poetry has no value at all. And that is why it's wonderful, right? It's bigger than value. It's bigger than value. It doesn't get anybody a promotion. it doesn't get anybody a dollar, right? A dollar, right? And, you know, that's why it's so special and why it's so wonderful. You know, when I was in graduate school in Seattle, I would go to these classes, and the professors were like really like world-class intellectuals, and they would just go to town, and they would be talking, and I myself, you know, had a pretty good education, but lots of people in my class were, you know, they were heavyweights intellectually, and I felt like I was a lightweight intellectually, and these people, you know, they were pretty privileged. They had grown up in, you know, some people, one person I knew, his father was in the Foreign Service, and he lived in Paris, and he spoke beautiful French. And I spoke French that I had learned in my high school French class, right? You know, that kind of thing. And I remember having a professor, anyway, we could go on and on, but, you know, I would always feel overmatched by my fellow students. And I remember coming out of one class where the professor was reading something in German, and I don't know German, right? You know, so everybody was talking about Heidegger, and I had not yet read Heidegger, you know. So I just felt like maybe I should go back to moving furniture for the Mayflower Moving Company, you know. And then I was walking home, and I looked up and I saw Mount Rainier, right? And Mount Rainier, just, if you know anything about Seattle, it's mostly cloudy, but every once in a while the clouds clear, and right behind the clouds, it's like somebody pulls a curtain, and right behind the curtain, there's this giant mountain. It's gigantic, and it's so big, it seems to float in the sky. And so I'm walking home and I'm thinking, God, you know, I'm just not up to this. You know, I really am not going to be an intellectual. That's obvious. And then I looked up and Mount Rainier was right there. And it was just like, it just blew everything away. It's like, who cares? Who cares? Right. And that experience is really not, that experience is priceless, because you suddenly realize these are just games that people play. They're just games. They're not real. And you see the artifice. It was so obvious to me that who cares if I've read Heidegger, right? Who cares? You know, who cares if I know German? I don't know German, and I didn't rush out to learn German. You know, it was just, I suddenly realized this is all these things that seem like a big matter in my class are really matters of almost no importance at all. And the pure beauty of this mountain floating in the sky was so liberating. So, you know, I think when people write books on the Zen of tennis or the Zen of finance or, you know, this sort of thing, or now it's mindfulness. Everything is mindfulness. Mindfulness and this, mindfulness and that. But actually, you know, this is a big mistake, because they're taking that mountain and they're drawing curtains over that mountain. They're turning Zen into an instrument of your purposes in life, which, well, of course, we should have purpose, right? But actually, we shouldn't have that much purpose. Sometimes the things that are really liberating in life are purposelessness, you know, purposeless, right? That's free. Zen has no purpose. That's why we should enjoy it, why we should pursue it. Because purposes come and go, and purposes make people miserable a lot of the time. You know, purposes also like trap people, right? You know, if you're worried so much about success or failure, maybe you're obsessively concerned because you're not doing something you really like or you really care about. You know, if you did something you really like, you wouldn't care about success or failure. You know, you just want to do it. You just want to do it, right? I mean, if you're motivated by this sense of things being alive and this sense of coming alive and being connected to things, then the question of success or failure drops away. That's a really, if I may say so, that's a really alienated way to look at life, right? very, very detached. You know, it's like there's a little gauge in your head and everything you do is being gauged. That's really artificial. So you know, it isn't really true that we Zen people are trying to achieve enlightenment. If enlightenment was something we could achieve, if it were something we could gain, it wouldn't be worth having. You know, enlightenment is discovering that is like seeing the mountain behind the clouds. It blows all of this away. It blows all of this away. You realize none of this matters. It's like, you know, I took a course with a guy who was the most important person in my department. He was the big shot in my department. He had published like 10 books. I won't tell you his name, but at the time I was his graduate student, you know, everybody envied me for being his. Now, you know, the truth is, if you mention his name, people go, who? Who is he? Who? You know, and you can go to the library and his books are all there, but, you know, I don't think anybody reads his books. Now, I don't take satisfaction in that, you know, because he was a very deep thinker and a wonderful scholar and a really brilliant creative person, but it doesn't matter really how many books he wrote, and it doesn't matter what his reputation was. What really matters is that, you know, he actually taught me how to read poetry, and he taught me how to be excited about poetry. That was the greatest gift he gave me wasn't his reputation, right? It was how to read a poem, you know? So I don't think he was in it, to be honest with you, for the prestige or the professor to his super senior titled chair. I don't think he cared about that. I think he just loved poetry. And it showed, because when he would talk about poetry, he was so alive. You know, he taught me how to love poetry, right? Which I hadn't really learned. So, you know, enlightenment is not what we think it is. It's not another merit badge on the sash if you were a Boy Scout or a Girl Scout. It's not another line on your CV. It's not money in the bank. You know, it's not a new car. You know, it's none of that. It's liberation from all of that. It's liberation from all of that. It's just seeing in this moment, we are all Mount Rainier, right? We are all Mount Rainier. This moment is our Mount Rainier. You know, it's full of mystery. It's infinite. It's infinitely beautiful. And it has no reason to be here, and neither do we. And when we are in that state of mind, that is Buddhist liberation. That is Buddhist liberation. So I'm not saying you should quit your job and live under a bridge, or that your work is pointless or futile. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying, you know, when we do things, it has to come from a place of freedom and a place of connection. And when we're engaging in that way, we realize there is no purpose to this. You know, this is like the natural unfolding of things. This is the natural unfolding of things. The master of Rengeho Cottage held out his staff and said to his disciples, "When in olden times a man reached the state of enlightenment, why did he not remain there?" In other words, don't cling to enlightenment. No, even enlightenment. See. Don't pursue enlightenment. Be enlightened. Don't cling to enlightenment. Be enlightened. No one could answer, and he replied for them, "Because it is of no use. It's useless in the course of your life." And then again he asked, after that, "What will you do? What will you do with the uselessness of life?" Right? Because life is useless. It's useless. It has no purpose. So what will you do with it now that you know it? And please, you know, enjoy your beautiful life. You know, enjoy your beautiful life. What will you do with it? And once again, he said, because nobody answered again, taking no notice of others, throwing his staff over his shoulders, he goes straight ahead and journeys deep into the recesses of the 100,000 mountains. So once we're free from the idea of usefulness and purpose and gain and loss, right and wrong, right? Suddenly life is like this journey into the deep into the recesses of the 100,000 mountains. So everything comes alive. Setro's verse, his eyes filled with sand, his ears with clay, even among the 1,000 mountains he does not remain. Falling blossoms, flowing streams, he leaves no trace, clinging to nothing. Open your eyes wide and you'll wonder where he's gone.